Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Perfectionists and procrastinators alike agree it's natural to dread a deadline. Whether your goal is to complete a masterpiece or just check off an overwhelming to-do list, the ticking clock signals despair. Editor, journalist, and writer Christopher Cox explores his experiences with the looming deadlines and how he became determined to learn the secret of managing them in his new book, The Deadline Effect, How to Work Like It's the Last Minute Before the Last Minute. Cox explains how readers can understand the psychological underpinnings of expectations and time, the dynamics of teams and customers, and techniques for using deadlines to make better, more assured decisions. Before a live audience at the Saratoga Performing Arts Center in Saratoga Springs, New York, we welcome Christopher Cox to this week's book show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, isn't it nice to talk to you? Thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So happy to be here.
How did you get this idea of exploring deadlines? I guess, obviously, being a journalist is something that you fight with all the time. Mm-hmm. Is that where it comes from?
Yeah, it came from my experience being an editor, where so much of my day-to-day job is just thinking about getting things done on time, and especially getting my writers to file to me on time to send me their stories in so we can get them in the magazine. And you listed some of the places I worked. Not all of those places were perfectly run organizations.
Oh, that's shocking.
Harper's Magazine is like famously sort of shabby and wonderful, but not a place you'd expect to be super efficient. But somehow, the magazine was founded in 1850, and it's never missed an issue every month. And so I started to think through that problem a little bit. I was like, what are they doing right that makes them so good as an institution at meeting deadlines? And then as soon as I started looking into that, I thought, well, let's find other organizations that I could study that had also mastered deadlines and look at some of their strategies. So to write the book, to report the book, I ended up embedding in 9 different organizations to study exactly how they worked.
So there are 9 case studies, there are 7 chapters, so really 7 that you focus on with 2 subplots.
That's right, yeah, exactly. The 2 that sort of get little miniature chapters are Airbus, the jet airplane builder, and the Public Theater in New York. And it's mainly because I saw the lessons they had to impart folding very neatly into a different case study, so I combined the 2.
You write that the deadline was originally the line on a printing press beyond which no type could be set, though publishers in turn had borrowed the term from the military during the Civil War. The deadline was a boundary surrounding the stockade outside of which any prisoner would be shot on sight. So that could explain why we're fearful of deadlines, I would assume.
Yeah, no. The term has a gruesome history, and I think most people also have gruesome associations with deadlines. Like they dread them. They worry about missing them, failing, and completing their projects on time. And so, hopefully, the book through the case studies and some of the psychological research that I cite in it will help people see them in a different light and in a more positive light as engines of productivity.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but you use the term deadline effect as a positive, which is generally in social sciences considered to be a negative.
Yeah, exactly. So like economists will probably look at my book and say, why did he call it that? The deadline effect is terrible. So the original meaning of deadline effect is it's when you delay action until the last minute. So it's often talked about in the social sciences and negotiations. So why is the court the settlement always reached on the courthouse steps, or why does a union negotiating with the city, why does that always have to take until the very last minute? And the deadline itself tends to incentivize people to wait until the very last minute. And so in the book, I talk a little bit about why that might be. I also note that, sure, things are happening at the last minute, but things are getting done. So what if we could take that power of the deadline, but apply it just a little more systematically so it's not rushed.
Here is the good news, I think, and I'll cut to the chase here, which is that to meet a deadline and to do it successfully, you do not have to curtail creativity.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that there is this sense that deadlines are could be the enemy of creativity. And I had it myself as an editor. My job when I worked at Harper's, when I worked at GQ, was to assign pieces to writers. And I had this vague sense that, oh, well, you know, if I give this writer all the time in the world, the final product will be better because they'll have more time to work on it. But actually, all I was doing was imposing more painful periods of procrastination on that writer, making them miserable. And if I actually just gave them less time and a very concrete deadline and held them to it, then I hastened the moment that they would be doing the productive creative work that they wanted to be doing.
So tell us about John.
So John is someone I mentioned in the beginning of the book. He wrote a story for me for GQ, and he's a brilliant writer. And he's someone that I thought, oh, well, you know, he needs extra time to work, so we'll just give him all the time he needs. And I think because I did that and other editors had made that same decision, he was famously late, famously past his deadlines. I mean, he had an assignment with The New Yorker that after 3 years. And
did he?
At GQ. And so he wrote a cover story for GQ, and I just basically ran experiment on him without telling him, which was said, okay, what if rather than saying, you know, turn it in when it's ready, turn it in when you've had time to do it, I said, no, actually, what if I give him the shortest amount of time I can possibly imagine giving a writer for a piece of this length? So I think I gave him like 5 days to write it. Normally I might have given him 3 or 4 months. And amazingly enough, he completed the assignment almost on time. He missed his deadline, but only missed it by a couple hours. And the quality of the prose was as good as if we'd given him the whole 3 months or however long he would normally take to write it.
Did he know that? Did he learn your lesson?
I don't think so. No. I don't think anyone else has tried this again with him. I mean, I asked for his permission to tell his story in the book, so he knows now that what I was doing at the time. But, you know, I think that unless we are very conscious about being creative and with setting deadlines and sticking to them, yeah, the tendency is to just let them slip and to say, you know, well, sometimes I say that the very worst deadline you can set is as soon as possible. But it's very tempting to set that one because you feel like, oh, well, that's the most urgent I could possibly be. But actually, a concrete deadline is much more effective than just saying as soon as possible.
So with that, there are the external deadlines, and then there are the self-imposed deadlines. Does one work better than the other?
Well, yes. External deadlines work better. If you can include enforcement mechanisms in meeting deadlines, and what does that mean? That means like an editor waiting for you to send your piece in, or it means, you know, if you're doing a project at work, your boss is waiting for you to finish it. Like, that helps you stick to the deadline, although your boss can help you out if he or she sets a concrete deadline and then maybe tries to set it a little shorter than you might normally expect. Repeat my experiment with John. But the good news from social science and reading some of the research about deadlines and time management is that even self-imposed deadlines that have no connection to the rest of the world, you know, you set a deadline for yourself to write a journal entry every day or whatever, are effective. Like they encourage creative productivity. So don't think just because you don't have an externally imposed deadline that it's not worth imposing one on yourself.
Is it helpful to put it on the calendar, circle it, and say this is the day?
Yeah, I mean, whatever it takes to lodge that date in your mind. I mean, you have to know the deadline to meet it.
You actually have used the word more in this interview than you do in the book, and that is procrastination, which you only use in the book. And yet, that's the devil, right? That's the evil that we are fighting when it comes to not meeting those deadlines.
Yeah, exactly. part of the reason that the procrastination comes up mainly in the introduction, I talk about some of the psychology behind it. But once we jump into the case studies, the reason that these places are successes is they have vanquished individual procrastination. Like, they've created structures that make it not an issue for getting things done. So I want to understand the problem and talk about the problem in the beginning of the book, but by the time you're learning about Airbus or whatever, it doesn't really come up in that business context because it doesn't affect their ability to meet their deadlines.
Christopher Cox is our guest on WAMC, and he is the author of the new book, The Deadline Effect, How to Work Like It's the Last Minute Before the Last Minute. You make the case that in many cases, and I believe I'm quoting you directly in the book here, that it is the rank and file workers rather than the managers who are most effective at harnessing deadlines. So how does that happen?
Well, I think that the way that I saw it play out in the places that I reported on was the structures in these organizations were in place, and it's the workers who are were the ones carrying it out. So, I mean, for example, in the first chapter is about a restaurant group, and there's a chef named Jean-Georges von Gerichten who has 40 restaurants around the world, and a lot of them are very fancy. It's a hard endeavor to open a restaurant that sort of gourmet, high-class restaurant, but he's done it over and over and over again. But it's not that Jean-Georges himself is sitting there in that restaurant cracking the whip and making sure that, you know, it opens on time. It's the sous chefs, it's the wait staff who get it done. And the reason they're able to do it is because of the way that they structure their approach to opening. And in Jean-Georges' case, what he does is for each new restaurant, they start serving mock service, like basically a full meal as if the restaurant were already open 2 months or more before the actual opening date. Jean-Georges is not there for those meals necessarily, but the wait staff is going through the motions of practicing serving, the chefs are practicing preparing the food. So by the time opening day actually arrives, the place is not only ready to open, but is fully buttoned up and is as good as it's going to be, you know, months after opening.
So what he has done, which is really remarkable, is to take what would typically be done on an independent, individual scale and replicated it 40 times over. I believe in the book you say the result is a group of restaurants that feels more like a commonwealth of independent states than an evil empire.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for catching that.
Yes. I just want to point out, there's also a great line in the book, and he said, you're describing the inside of a room, and you said it looked like it was decorated when Dallas was on the air. Another one of my favorite lines.
Yeah.
So, but the idea back to Jean-Georges is that, okay, so we talk about the rank and file, and they're following that. But it also, at the same time, you tell us about this restaurateur, a lily farmer, a ski resort CEO. These folks have experience. They know what they're doing. They have done it a long time, and they achieve this because they're good at what they do. I mean, that really helps the equation, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. You know, the CEO of Telluride, for example, was very thoughtful about deadlines and had fully formed philosophies about how to meet them. But that didn't have to be the case, or it wasn't the case in every place I went to. The family farms are actually an interesting example. So I went to, there are four lily farms in Northern California and Southwestern Oregon that grow all of the Easter lilies that are sold in the United States and Canada. They're all family farms. And that crop, it's a very unusual crop. It's a white flower, and it's basically only sold for Easter Sunday. One of the farmers there told me, like, the day after Easter Sunday, an Easter lily is worthless. So they really have to stick to a schedule. I mean, and the way that those farms had stuck to the schedule, had met their deadlines year after year, was basically this knowledge of generations that was passed down from family farmer to family farmer and communicated to the workforce. And, you know, so that's not the insight of a singular genius. That's institutional memory. That's the institution itself creating the ability to meet this deadline so consistently.
And like any family, there's all kinds of dysfunction and family members not talking to each other, and yet still gets done.
Yeah, exactly. Just like Harper's Magazine. The individuals can be as unorganized as they come, but the institution itself still pushes you towards meeting the deadline.
Because in the Lily chapter, you have a scene where a guy is literally on his back as this conveyor belt goes through, sort of picking out the bad bulbs. I mean, it comes down to that, but that's the check that everything's going to be okay.
Oh yeah, I mean,
or one of.
Well, my experience of being on those Lily farms is these people care so deeply about their product, their crop. Almost all the farms, it's been multiple generations producing it. That was, you know, the owner climbing into the conveyor belt which sorts the lily bulbs. They're very devoted to getting that flower out. And if they did, you know, Easter lilies, so it's good that they do.
Let us not say that you give a tremendous amount for your job and for your craft. You took a job working at Best Buy on, wait for it, Black Friday. Actually, Thanksgiving and Black Friday.
Well, at Best Buy, they call Thanksgiving the day before Black Friday. Yeah, but yes.
Anyone surprised? Anyone? No. So, good for you. I found that chapter to be fascinating because
charming.
You want them to be big box store destroying the world, and yet they make other places look more evil.
Yeah, I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't have a whole lot of sympathy in my heart for big box stores. But once I joined the staff and met the people who were making Black Friday possible at this one Best Buy on Long Island, it's hard not to feel, you know, to cheer for them and to root for them and the whole staff came together to make this possible. It's mainly young people, although there's a mix of ages, and they were charmingly uncynical about the whole process. Like, they were part of the team and they really wanted to make this big day, the biggest sales day of the year, a success.
So the deadline there is Black Friday. Everything gets ready for Black Friday. They get ready as time goes on. And you talk about this fascinating where they place boxes on the floor as if to corral people so they go where they need to go. Mm-hmm. And all of this is predicated on the knowledge, the known fact that the morning or the evening at 5 o'clock when those doors open, all hell's going to break loose.
Yes, for sure. So I think they took seriously how bad Black Fridays can get at various places. In fact, the place that I worked was across the parking lot from a Walmart where there was a death during a Black Friday. Okay. So the stakes can get very high. Someone was trampled to death. This Best Buy and all Best Buys have put in place all these procedures to basically make the flow of customers to the store safe and predictable and efficient. And so, as you say, they actually take flat screen TVs. I was a flat screen salesman while I was there.
Congratulations. Yeah. What, 30,000 you said? 30 to 40,000?
I think 30 to 40, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Don't
no, I
skimp
won't.
On the higher end there. I sold a lot of TVs in my basically 1 month working there. But they take these product boxes, these TV boxes, and they use it to divide the store into sections. So if you are coming in for Black Friday and you've decided what you really want is a certain TV, you can only go to the TV section. If you decide that what you want is an Xbox, you can only go to the gaming section or the appliance section or whatever it is. That's crowd control. The other really smart thing they did was the most sought-after item was a particularly cheap TV. And they took that outside of the store altogether. You would get a ticket, and you would line up around the back of the store, and you would get it at the loading dock. And it's just another way to prevent that sort of that crunch of customers. And so this is all part of a chapter where I talk about how the Best Buy basically remakes itself to meet this deadline, and how if you're facing a particularly big project and an important project, you know, you might have to do that as an organization.
Because they were on the brink of going out there for a while, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. They declared bankruptcy in 2013, I think.
Yeah. So they were able to come out of that.
Yes. Yeah. They're a rare success story, I think, when it comes to competing with Amazon, basically. They still exist because of some of the changes that they made, including making Black Friday a success.
So in that case, Black Friday is the deadline. In the case of John Delaney, who was seeking the Democratic nomination for president in 2020, remember him?
I see a lot of John Delaney fans here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So was the first or near the first, one of the first?
He was the very first person to declare his candidacy for 2020.
And as you write, I just think brilliantly, is that the deadline here is to get on the debate stage, because mm-hmm. you have to achieve factors, which I'll let you explain, and to do that, to get on that debate stage, you have to click those things off, three things, and you get on the stage. And for him to move on, that was absolutely a necessity, given he's not a household name.
Yeah, exactly.
And apparently still isn't.
His best shot, if he was going to make it as this dark horse candidate, as someone with very little name recognition, was to get into the first debate and then make a big splash, and then that could start the momentum. It was a good theory, and probably the best theory that he had to make it. I don't know. Maybe some of you remember that first debate, but he did okay in the first debate. And actually, you automatically qualified for the second debate. So it was in the second debate that he had like a head-to-head confrontation with Elizabeth Warren, in which she sort of, she basically said, he's a moderate. He was running as a moderate, at least. And she said, I don't understand why you'd run for president if you don't want to try to do big things. And that basically finished his chances. But before Elizabeth Warren dispensed with him, he succeeded in his goal. You know, he set this goal of making the debate stage, and he made it there. And the way you make it onto the first Democratic primary debate stage is you have to get 1% in three different polls. Doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, in that crowded field, it was actually difficult. And so what Delaney did is he had all these plans before that became his goal. And he was going to do a 50-state bus tour. He was going to try to go on TV a lot. But as soon as they announced those rules for that first debate, 3 1% polls, he changed his strategy. And he said, okay, I'm going to do what I have to do to get those polls. So he focused all of his attention on Iowa, which is where the most polling is done in the early days. And he went to every single one of the 99 counties of Iowa in order to try to pick up that 1%, and it worked. That strategy worked for him.
There's a point where I believe you're on the bus with him, talking to him, and he pretty much admits that he's not going to win.
Yes, you know, he's pretty
practical,
candid about his chances. Yeah.
So, but is that still a success? Is that a deadline success?
Well, you know, deadlines are not a magic wand that you can wave. I can't set a deadline to become, you know, the president of the United States, for example, or I can't set a deadline to become an astronaut and have it work just because I set the deadline. But he, by you know, carefully planning his approach to this campaign and setting this deadline of, I have to make the DNC stage, he gave himself his best shot. It didn't work out, but you know, it was better than he might have done otherwise.
I mean, really, the point that you make in the book, and I'll mention that the entire title, The Deadline Effect: How to Work Like It's the Last Minute Before the Last Minute. So that idea of working very hard at the end but enjoying the process, making it work for you, being creative, all of that is very possible if you set yourself up for some degree of success.
Yes, no, absolutely. And, you know, the goal is to eliminate the pain of procrastination, the pain of not getting things done, and also achieve the highest quality end product that you possibly can. And so everything you can do to push your deadline forward, to start working earlier, will get you towards that. And, you know, at least I find that when I'm actually being productive, when I'm making great progress towards a project, that's when I'm happiest.
One of the things that I realized as I was getting ready for this interview is that I was really self-conscious about getting the book read and getting my notes done, because it would suck to not meet a deadline when you're talking to a guy who's written a book about deadlines. And that lasted for about a nanosecond until I thought, oh, poor Christopher. What did you go through?
No, it was definitely clear to me from the very beginning that I would have to finish this book on time before I signed the contract. But I ended up finding that quite useful and in a way liberal.
Christopher Cox's new book is The Deadline Effect, How to Work Like It's the Last Minute Before the Last Minute. It's published by Avid Reader Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Find more out about SPAC at spac.org. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.